The views expressed on AM360 by the host, hostesses, or guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Share Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific and personal medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM360 or CWSC. We encourage you to consult an advisor for your specific circumstances.
You have listened to us over 500,000 times. American Muslim 360.
That's interesting.
Assalamu alaikum. This is American Muslim 360 radio broadcast.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Ar-Rahmanir Rahim. مالك يوم الدين إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
American Muslim 360 is
too legit, too legit to quit.
We will never quit. American Muslim 360, your number one Muslim radio station.
You can't touch this. You can't touch this.
Community-wide Shura Conference and American Muslim 360 invites you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation. Affordable rates allow you to promote your event and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. Contact corporate underwriting today at cwsconline@gmail.com. That's cwsconline@gmail.com. Or call 910-317-0297. Again, 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
Inshallah, when I grow up, I'm going to join CWSC. I'm going to help remake the world for you and me. I'm going to be part of MCNRD and contribute my talent, my expertise. I'm going to apply for a CWSC scholarship someday in honor of a pioneer. I pray I grew up to be a leader, a strong woman, courageous with no fear. But until that day, I need you to stand in my place and be part of the group intellect until I can join the race. Visit cwsc.us because together we can remake the world.
We rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons, with the certainty of tides. Just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my sadness upset you? Don't take it so hard just because I laugh. As if I have gold mines digging in my own backyard. You can shoot me with your words. You can cut me with your lies. You can kill me with your hatefulness. But just like life, I'll rise. Does my sexiness offend you? Oh. Does it come as a surprise that I dance? As if I have diamonds at the meeting of my thighs. Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, naturally, there I go rising.
Have you ever heard the phrase, don't drink and drive? Just imagine the healthcare costs and the lives or the families and marriages and careers that maybe, just maybe, could have been saved if we just changed the sentence to two words instead of four. Don't drink. A public service message from American Muslim 360 and CWSC.
Introducing the CWSC cloning program, where we combine just the right DNA to create expertise on demand right in the laboratory. Need an accountant or food bank specialist to help you design that community outreach program? Or maybe you need an IT specialist to help you with your website. Whatever the need, the CWSC cloning program does not exist. If we want expertise, it's going to take you and me inside the MCNRD, the Model Communities National Resource Directory. Visit CWSC.us today, because we are the change we've been waiting for. Cloning won't do it, but trusting the group intellect will. Visit CWSC.us and register in the Model Communities National Resource Directory today, because together we can remake the world.
Are the ones we've been waiting for. We are the change that we seek.
Would you rather be sinless or would you rather sin less? One's just impossible to achieve, and the other, well, our Lord just doesn't ask us to attempt the impossible. Want to know more? Find someone less fortunate than you and extend a helping hand or a kind word. A public service message from the CWSC and AM 360.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Nirmat Shaheed, restorative justice practitioner for the Oakland Unified School District and host on AM 360's The Pearls of Women Quranic Mondays. We're asking you to help us make a difference in the life of a student. We need you to spread the word that CWSC is offering 5 college scholarships in the form of direct financial aid to students who qualify and are graduating from high school this year or current college students. Learn more and apply online today at cwsc.us. But hurry, the deadline for applications is June the 20th. Thank you for helping secure our next generation's intelligentsia. Assalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillah, because there is no God but Assalamu alaikum. Godspeed be upon you. This is an official update for dialing in to the Community Wise Shura Conference and American Muslim 360. Now you can listen 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 701-719-4197. You can listen to the pre-recorded presentations by the various hosts here at American Muslim 360 broadcast or the live presentations. You will be pleased with what you hear, and we are thankful for your tuning in to the most listened to Islamic station in the nation, where your voice is protected and your intellect respected. Please stay tuned for more information.
By virtue of extraordinary and consistent sharing with the American Muslim 360 listenership of unique cultural arts in the form of poetry that appeals to the intellect, heart, and ear, and by a superior ability to uncannily construct poetic pieces almost immediately by capturing the spirit and letter of any number of topics covered on the airwaves of American Muslim 360, now, Dr. Aisha Kareem, the Chief Executive Officer of American Muslim 360, with the concurrence of the CWSC Board of Directors, do hereby appoint Bilal Kareem Abdullah of New Orleans, Louisiana, American Muslim 360's Poet Laureate. And we call on all believers to recognize his title of honor, signifying his respect for the group, intellect in the work of our national intelligentsia and his commitment thereto and our respect for his contribution. Together we can remake the world. Done this 8th day of May 2018 and at the approach of the blessed month of Ramadan.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Imam Abdul Aziz, CWSC's board member, director of the CWSC Ambassador Programs and National Leadership Advisory Council, and host of AM360's Ma'iyah Al-Kulihal, inviting you to share in the special blessings of interfaith unity in the national campaign honoring the blessed month of Ramadan. All month long, you're invited to participate in the Return to Innocence, Sharing the Spirit of Ramadan campaign, in which Islamic institutions nationwide are being asked to include at least one interfaith event with another Islamic organization in the same metropolitan area, and preferably with an organization that represents a new or renewed relationship that may cross cultural, ethnic, or language barriers. In other words, all of us are being asked to share time with one another in a way we may have never done before. We're asking all to work this month with unprecedented interfaith unity and unconditional positive regard and reconciliation. Examples of joint events might be praying together on the occasion of Jum'ah or another congregational prayer, one joint iftar, a masjid movie day, a youth appreciation day, joint press conference, joint resolution for city welcoming and explaining Ramadan to a joint open house, a joint day of community service or outreach such as neighborhood cleanup or food drive, and of course, the ultimate, a joint Eid celebration. The second part of the Return to Innocence campaign is reconciliation, and it applies to any circumstances in which independent local institutions in the same city have suffered a breach between their organizations as a result of past grievances or misunderstandings. We are asking leaders of those institutions to meet first in private with a commitment to heal the division, followed by action to bring their entire communities together for one event during the blessed month. Finally, we ask you to share with us your event success stories and photos with CWSC so we can share them with the entire American Muslim community. Email us at info@cwsc.us. Finally, AM360 may feature your community's interfaith unity success story in a national interview. Just imagine the power of all of us together as brothers and sisters, solely for the sake of Allah, during this month. Imagine what the angels will say to our Lord and what our Lord will say to us. We ask Allah's choice and blessings upon you, your family, and community. Together, we can remake the world. Ramadan Mubarak. Assalamu alaikum.
the boy who used to delay his prayers. He remembered his grandmother's warning about praying on time. "My son, you shouldn't leave prayer to this late time." His grandmother's age was 70, but whenever she heard the adhan, she got up like an arrow and performed salah. He, however, could never win over his ego to get up and pray. Whatever he did, his salah was always the last to be offered, and he prayed it quickly to get it done on time. Thinking of this, he got up and realized that there were only 15 minutes left before Salatul Isha. He quickly made wudu and performed Salatul Maghrib. While making tasbih, he again remembered his grandmother and was embarrassed by how he had prayed. His grandmother prayed with such tranquility and peace. He began making dua and went down to make sajda and stayed like that for a while. He had been at school all day and was tired, so tired. He awoke abruptly to the sound of noise and shouting. He was sweating profusely. He looked around. It was very crowded. Every direction he looked, it was filled with people. Some stood frozen looking around. Some were running left and right. Some were on their knees just waiting. Pure fear and apprehension filled him as he realized where he was. His heart was about to burst. It was the Day of Judgment. When he was alive, he had heard many things about the questioning on the Day of Judgment. But that seemed so long ago. Could this be something his mind made up? No, the weight and the fear were so great that he could not have possibly imagined this. The interrogation was still going on. He began moving frantically from person to person to ask if his name had been called. No one can answer him. All of a sudden, his name was called and the crowd split into two and made a passageway for him. Two angels grabbed his arms and led him forward. He walked with unknowing eyes through the crowd. The angels brought him to the center and left him there. His head was bent down, and his whole life was passing in front of his eyes like a movie. He opened his eyes but saw only another world. He sweated like never before and was shaking all over. His eyes were fixed on the scale, waiting the final decision. At last, the decision was made. The angels with two sheets of paper in their hands turned to the crowd. His legs felt like they were going to collapse. He closed his eyes as they began to read the names of those people who were to enter Jahannam, hell. His name was read first. He fell on his knees and yelled that this couldn't be. How could I go to Jahannam? I served others all my life. I spread the word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to others. His eyes had become blurry and he was shaking with sweat. The two angels approached and took him by the arms as his feet dragged. They went through the crowd and advanced towards the blazing flames of Jahannam. He was yelling and wondering if there was any person who was going to help him. He was yelling of all the good deeds he'd done, how he had helped his father, his fast, his prayer, the Quran he read. He was asking if none of them would help him. The Jahannam angels continued to drag him. They had gotten closer to the hellfire. He looked back, and these were his last pleas. How clean would a person be who bathes in a river five times a day? So too does the salah performed five times cleanse someone of their sins. He began yelling, "My prayers, my prayers, my prayers." The two angels did not stop, and they came to the edge of the abyss of Jahannam. The flames of the fire were burning his face. He looked back one last time, but his eyes were dry of hope. He had nothing left in him. One of the angels pushed him in. He found himself in the air, falling towards the flames. He had just fallen 5 or 6 feet when a hand grabbed him by the arm and pulled him back. He lifted his head and saw an old man with a long white beard. He wiped some dust off of himself and asked him, "Who are you?" The old man replied, "I am your prayer. Why are you so late? I was almost in the fire. You rescued me at the last minute before I fell in." The old man smiled and shook his head. "You always performed me at the last minute. And did you forget?" At that instant, he blinked and lifted his head from sajda. He was in a sweat. He listened to the voices coming from outside. He heard the adhan for Salatul Isha. He got up quickly and went to perform wudu. The moral of this story is, say your prayers before your prayers for you are said.
Well, the first thing I need to do is lower expectations. I'm not going to tell you a lot of what you know today. I think sometimes when I go to trainings, I end up hearing a lot of things that I knew were good ideas, and maybe I forgot, misplaced, wasn't doing. So I hope that that is definitely a little bit about what we'll discuss today. But I'm going to go through a few things I think that are just mundane. And while I do, if you wouldn't mind, because we're going to discuss evaluation, And this really is a little bit of what I would call a type of intervention. We're having a training here. I have a pretest in the front, or actually it's right behind, I think, your handout for the PowerPoint slides. If you wouldn't mind just taking a couple minutes while I kind of drone on a couple of background things about logic models, which may or may not be interesting to you, but I always find that it's good to understand things from the background. If you would complete that, I would greatly appreciate it. But before that, I need you to look up here because I'm more than all that stuff that Tim just said. I'm a dad to a beautiful little girl, and wait for it, she is now a big sister as of 6 days ago. This is Esme. She was born on the 1st, New Year's baby. She was the first girl born in Boone in 2014. So, okay, so while you're filling that out, I'll just kind of talk a little bit about the overview of three modules that I want to put together to help build some capacity on what we're talking about and where we're going. The first module we're going to cover today really answers the what question about program evaluation. It's intended to help you communicate effectively what it is that you're doing, linking the direct services or activities at your agency to meaningful community level outcomes. The second module is really the how. So we're going to talk about actual performance measurement, how to find measures, how to link them to conceptually to the intended targets that you are aiming at. And then the third module is the why, which really is focused on helping us explain to other folks using some data, using some methods about how effective our program is, why it's important to the community, and also it will be helpful to apply for external funding. So that's the kind of the broad overview. So for today, discussing logic models, briefly, just some background history. We're going to look at the stages and phases of program evaluation, which I think is important. Most of you maybe are in different stages of this process. I think it is iterative, or it repeats itself continually. We're going to talk also about social problems, specifically how we identify mediators as program targets. These are meaningful, malleable, or changeable situations related with larger problems like poverty, larger problems like diseases, community level issues. Then we're going to break down the logic model elements briefly, and hopefully have some time at the end for a little bit of application and consultation. So a logic model is and again, I'm not going to tell you all probably something that you don't know today, but indulge me for a minute. A logic model is really a flat representation of what it is that you do at your agencies or at your programs. I think that they're important for communicating to stakeholders, which are your clients, which are people that you want to obtain funding from. I think particularly important for clients. They need to know what exactly it is that agencies do. Communicates a theory of change. I think this is an acronym for a logic model, theory of change, also called a conceptual model sometimes. It depends on who's talking. I think that's some of the confusion around logic models sometimes and some of these concepts is there's a lot of uncommon language. And so I think one of the biggest barriers is people talk about these concepts differently. So I hope to kind of bridge some of that today. Helps list resources, inform your budget development. Actually, if a logic model is done properly, your budget justification can follow right along with it, and you can make it clear to funders what exactly you're asking for, how it's going to be used. Organizes program activities. This is particularly important, I think, for a lot of social service agencies. So when I was a principal and I worked with a lot of low-income kids in my building, I had a lot of staff turnover. I didn't have a lot of money. Some of us don't have the resources to pay folks what they're worth. And so we see a lot of coming and going. And so staff training is important. And having some of these things organized can really facilitate training of new staff that have to come in and fill those holes when we need them. Fidelity monitoring is an important aspect of program evaluation, and I'm going to talk about that, and I think that logic model can help organize process evaluation, or what I call fidelity evaluation. We can link conceptually or visually the sequence of events that we want to see occur as outcomes, and we directly connect our program activities to what it is that we intend to change. Brief history. I'm going to drone on about this. I like history, so I'm always looking at the history of things. I want to know why things happen. They occur for a reason. They have a whole backdrop, right? So, you know, I started digging into this and really thinking about it, and I hadn't really looked at it until this training. I was like, you know, where did these things start? So I started reading and looking back, and, you know, these things kind of first appeared in the 50s in research circles as a way to talk about complex ideas and how they were conceptually linked over time. A gentleman named Suchman really brought it to program or intervention research. And then really in the 1990s, the United Way of America, bless their heart. Anybody ever seen this before? Yeah, so this is, I have taught program research and evaluation for these 8 years now, and I've used this book. Is published in 1995. My students look at it still and they're like, why am I getting this antiquated book? I'm telling you, this is probably the best manual ever written on this subject. And so I use it still today. I love it. My students who are born in the age of the internet don't think it's so great. But there's another document out here by the RAND Corporation. It is similar to this document here. It is free. I think, I'm not sure if this is free. Do you know? I'm not sure if it's free or not. I paid for it. But the RAND Corporation also has a similar kind of document that lays out the steps here. And it's really about building capacity from the ground up. I mean, grassroots kind of things, you know, building buy-in and taking your program forward. So it's a good document to read as well if you can find it. Benefits of logic models, you know, almost every major funder requires a logic model. You know, it's just, it's such an easy way to communicate ideas. Even state and local, as well as private organizations are requiring logic models more and more. All of the major institutes, federal institutes, require logic models. Reason being, it really enhances clarity in how we communicate our ideas. You know, some of the things that we do, the social interventions that we engage in, they're complex, and we are engaging in trying to alter difficult situations through multiple ways, multiple pathways, and so we have to be able to describe that. And sometimes in narrative format, it can get very jumbled up, so logic models can help put these things together. Really helps to unpack the structure of an organization. I think it can help with fiscal orderliness. I think that if many agencies offer multiple services, do multiple activities, some of them at multiple levels, and I think that we can put together multi-element or multimodal logic models, which I'll touch upon briefly today, in order to explain these kinds of activities. And it really, as Steve was saying, helps with quality assurance. That we can establish some causal claims that we are making an impact if we are measuring and developmentally looking at some of the issues in the correct way. So I think it's also important, one of the things that we don't look at a lot of time are process evaluation. You know, how well are we delivering services? What is it that we can do to try to deliver them better? And how do we use that information to make mid-course corrections? So what's the problem? I'm not going to stand up here and tell you again that I'm going to tell you anything that's earth-shattering, but I will say that transition's hard, and I think that what is occurring here in this community, I think there's a zeitgeist. I think there's a great opportunity for really the kind of collaboration and partnership necessary to really create community-level change. I think the difficulty is we're living now in an environment of shrinking resources. I'm not going to sugarcoat it for you. Most of you know how difficult it is to operate on soft funding. But I think it gets even more difficult when we start talking about systems level change, which I think is really what's happening here. That's really what we're discussing. We're discussing individual partners that are engaged in activities to create a community level impact. I think there are a lot of language barriers, as I said before. It depends on who's talking about these things, but disciplines talk about them separately using different kinds of terminology. I oftentimes think that these things have been repackaged so many times because academics need a research agenda of their own. Drives me nuts, especially coming from education and seeing all these interventions come down the pipeline. They all look the same, but they've got different terms. It just horks teachers off. They've got to learn a whole new set of acronyms every year. I think that there's a lot of fear of appraisal of this kind of process, that if I'm not performing up to standard, will my funding be cut? I personally don't see it that way. I see it as a tool to help myself when I was a principal, a tool to help me operate a better program. That's how I choose to see it, not saying that if something isn't working, that it's not going to get cut, but if something isn't working, what am I going to do about it? And I popped this slide in there because I got started with this whole process. So I'm a second-year professor, and I came to Columbia because I saw a lot of opportunity, and I just meeting with some people in the community, I realized that this is a place that I wanted to be because I'm interested in applying research and bridging the gap between research and practice. And I think there's a lot of possibilities here. So as part of teaching my research class, my students took 19 proposals from the United Way, and we kind of unpacked them, and we looked, we basically dissected them using a logic model and thinking about it in what I would call evidence-based practice, which is a social work term, scientifically based supports, whatever we all hear it. It comes from the medical community. Social work's been using that term for 20 years. And what I saw was about less than 15% of the proposals we looked at properly specified the problem. And I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by that. Fewer than 26 actually proposed scientifically based supports or programs. Less than 5% linked activities, outputs, and outcomes in sequence. And less than 5% specified an accurate measurement model. And I'm not bashing this. This is difficult stuff. Don't get me wrong. I tell you what, I got up this morning and I have heard many of your names as I heard you kind of introduce yourself in here and some of the cool things that you're doing. And I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I know your business. That's not the point. I was getting dressed this morning. My wife says, "You look very nice." I was like I'm going to a funeral. She said, no, you're going to do fine. I was like, well, okay. I only raise this because this is really the fact of what I saw. And I think that all of you have the pieces and the parts in there, and all of you know this process, but I think actually putting it in boxes and laying the process out systematically, as I think we can do with the funding proposals through the United Way, will create this forum of common language and measurement across the board that will ultimately benefit you and your program. So a little constructive criticism on the proposals I saw. All right, phases and stages of program evaluation. So this is from the CDC. Ultimately, the stages of program evaluation nest within the phases of program evaluation. So to ascertain the need in a community and identify scientifically based programs are really the planning process where we do a needs assessment. What's the need for the program? Developing the evaluation design and collecting evidence is really part of the implementation process. We are doing this as part of the implementation process, and the logic model helps us lay out a plan to do that. Justifying the data and utilizing the data in policy and program decisions is really about the maintenance process, how we use the outcome as well as process information to as a feedback loop to inform what it is that we're doing. Now this looks pretty ugly. I tried to create this whole diagram while fitting the logic model in there to see how they all relate, and they do relate. And to be honest with you, it was not as ugly as I originally had. I had a bunch of feedback loops in here. But ultimately, I think that these three processes map onto the evaluation aspects, or the three groups of evaluation aspects. And the logic, and I basically have drawn out how the logic model really informs each step in this process. I would say that even above this whole process is what I would call your agency's mission statement, which is a broad statement about what it is that we do, who it is that we do it for, and why. But we've got to drill down farther than that. We've got to get more specific, right? Particularly if we want to attract funding, and particularly if we want to make sure that what we're doing makes a difference. Different kinds of evaluation questions, and I don't think that this is exhaustive. But when we're planning, again, we're asking, what are the service gaps? Who needs them? Is there public support for the program? What do I need to operate it? Is there compliance once we get to the actual implementation? Is there compliance, or are we operating the program with fidelity? So monitoring those outputs really answers this question. Is there increased support for the program in the community? So that's really about consumer satisfaction surveys, really. How satisfied are you with the services you're receiving? Consumer satisfaction is not an outcome, and I think it often gets confused as one. Are practitioners or end users pleased with the program? So consumer satisfaction, but also the practitioners. We know that individuals who offer a service, whether it be counseling, whether it be you name it, if they are pleased with what it is that they're doing, or they feel that some things need to change, the happier people generally are, research shows, that the more faithful they actually implement the process. The more faithful we implement the process, the more effective it is. Outcome evaluation questions are really looking at the cognitive or behavioral and even health impacts, economic impacts potentially if that is relevant to the program. Other questions that we can answer are there dosage or moderation effects. So this is really about individual differences between people. Do men versus women or boys versus girls experience a program differently? Do individuals of high income versus low income experience the program differently? And I think more important and sometimes left out of the equation here or the question is, are there iatrogenic effects or are there unintended consequences of what it is that we're doing? Sometimes we do things in schools with kids who have behavioral problems. There are lots of unintended problems with those interventions. We isolate those kids. We identify those kids to their peers, and that's an important developmental issue at that time period in their life, right? So let's talk about mediators. I love mediation. Defining a social problem. So I'm going to go back to one of the issues I saw with the proposals, which I didn't see the problem properly specified. When we suggest that a program addresses a huge community level or population level issue like poverty or teen pregnancy, drug abuse, aggression, that belongs in the mission statement. It does not belong in the measurement or how it is that we talk about a program. Really, the problem statement itself needs to include some very specific information. But one of the things that we're often missing is reference to the broad strategy or approach that we actually are using to target the problem. These are the malleable predictors or highly correlated conditions with the issue of poverty, with the issue of teen pregnancy, right? Parent-child interaction therapy, anybody know about that? It's awesome therapy. The therapy is focused on specifically the mediators of increasing parent coping skills, social supports, and positive parenting strategies. These are malleable things. We know that we can teach people better parenting strategies. If we're aiming to reduce the real big community level problem of child abuse, then these are pathways to do that. Mediators are the indicators and intervening mechanisms that programs target. They are the things we are aimed at, right? I mean, sometimes if we say we're trying to reduce poverty or improve economic conditions, man, you can get all over the map squirrely with that sort of approach, right? I mean, that's a difficult problem. And poverty is on the map this year. I think the Pope's helped with that. They are immediate outcomes most of the time. I think, and as we'll talk about, the farther away we get in the measurement model, the more difficult it is to attribute effects to the program. And that's just a reality of what it is that we do in the work that we do. But generally, mediators are the immediate outcomes that you want to look at. They are constantly measured alongside all of the other outcomes, as well as process measures. And they explain the variance in the outcome. So what I mean by that is if we have a program that looks at reducing recidivism, which is a community-level problem, and we are able to show that that program has a significant relationship with the reduction in recidivism for individuals who receive the program versus individuals who do not, what we can see is if the program is what we're really doing is targeting empathy. Let's say we have an intervention that teaches individual offenders. They sit and listen to the stories of victims. There's a whole therapy model around this. It's, you know, and it's been shown to be somewhat effective. But we can see that through this model that we have a significant association of the program with increasing or improving empathy among those individuals. We can see that there's a significant association between the empathy and the outcome of recidivism. In other words, individuals who are high on empathy also are low on recidivism. But what happens when we put all of this in a statistical model together, along with a lot of other things to control for the difference between individuals, is that that cancels out, that disappears. And we know that that is a powerful mediator, and that is how we come up with a whole list of proximal outcomes for a variety of community or population level problems. School dropout, we're looking at engagement, bonding, relationships, these things we know matter. School readiness, I love school readiness. This is a place that we need to focus because this makes a difference.
Hey, I have a question. Going
yes, sir.
To the previous slide,
sure.
You're saying that if you follow your letters A and B right, C won't matter anymore?
No, C matters. It's, what I'm saying is that, and I don't want to get too bogged down in the statistics of it, but when we enter these two variables in a statistical equation along with other individual differences or individual level variables that explain some differences in the outcome, we see a significant relationship between the program and the outcome. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is that when we then enter the mediator into that model, the significant association between the program and the outcome diminishes because the mediator explains the change.
Oh, okay.
Does that make sense to everybody? I'm sorry if I didn't clearly express myself. And please stop me because sometimes I will roll right over the top of things that I'm saying and not pay attention to actually what's coming out of my mouth. I get paid to talk a lot, so. Okay. So let's move on to logic model elements here. Again, I think that most of you are familiar with this process. I will start by saying there is no one right way to build a logic model, and doesn't that feel uncomfortable? But I think there's a common way. I think there's a meaningful way. I think that how we talk about these kinds of conceptual models and research don't make sense for program evaluation. They didn't make sense to me as a principal. They make a little bit more sense to me as a researcher, but I think that I want to talk to you about it in a way that helps with program level evaluation. Inputs. We're really talking about the resources we need to operate a program. All of you are intimately familiar with what those needs are. The activities are really the actions that we are doing to deliver the services that we need. What are we going to do to affect change? The outputs are the units that are the units offered. So what kind of, how much work was done, how many people received access to it. This is not an outcome, but an outcome is really what is the effect of the work that is done. A lot of similar language, but the reason that we put these things in these boxes is we show some if-then relationships. If we provide these outputs, then we see these activities. If we have these activities, then we see the outputs. If we have the outputs, then we see the outcomes. So I'll unpack this just a little bit more. One of the important parts of intervention research is unpacking the black box of what's actually in the intervention, and this is part of the process. Staff and time, contracted services, facilities, technology, collaborative relationships, if that's necessary part of what you're doing. Contracts, if that's also part of what you're doing. I don't think that you have to actually estimate the specific number that you need in the logic model. Brief statements are appropriate. Really, you're going to explain more of the detail in your narrative. The logic model is just a picture to refer to in the narrative, right? But I think that what can also be beneficial about the inputs is actually building your itemized budget, keeping it parallel in nature, so that if you list number of staff first in your logic model, that in your budget narrative, that's the first thing you talk about, so that your readers can go back and forth between your budget narrative and your logic model and make sense about what you're talking about. I don't know, I provided a couple of examples here. I think that sometimes we can be too specific. Again, I think that this is more for a budget narrative, the far right column. The middle column is about right. So if we're trying to buy a house, I don't know. I made up some things here, but we don't need to list every single specific financial records, but just that we are going to list the financial records. And then in my budget narrative, I would talk about every single financial record I'm going to get, right? The activities, I like to use verbs here when building these logic models. And if possible, putting an ing on it. I didn't do that here. Making them active. This is what we're doing. And these are really where we start talking about the mediators that are highly associated with the greater problem that we're trying to affect. You got to know the research in your area. I think that sometimes this can be a little bit of a research-oriented issue. But reading some of that research and that literature can help make you familiar with what are the specific malleable indicators associated with the larger problem that you're dealing with. And what are the programs or effective scientific supports that actually work to change those things? So I'll hire a real estate agent, maybe not detailed enough. The middle column there, a little too detailed. Maybe more appropriate for a work plan, which I think is also a benefit of the logic model, is really aligning the activities so that I can develop a work plan, or within my agency I can designate some individuals to work on that. How are we going to do this? Figure it out. The bottom box being just right, just a little bit of information about what it is that we're doing. And again, you're going to explain and expand upon it more in the narrative. And when I say in parallel format, I think that if you put it first in the logic model, talk about it first in the narrative. That is a good grant writing strategy. Winner every time. The outputs. They are the direct byproducts of our activities. It is literally taking off the ing action word from our activities and putting a number in front of the output. And I don't think that we have to be specific here. Like, I don't need to say that I'm going to offer 30 counseling sessions or that I'm going to hand out 1,500 buddy packs. But that you can count those things, that's the point. This is important because this is really, I think sometimes people overlook the importance of this box right here. This is really where we start getting at program fidelity. I'm not talking about fidelity between you and your spouse. It's fidelity, sticking to the program, sticking to the plan. How well did we stick to the plan? The outputs are evidence of that. If we're seeing that we're not sticking to certain parts of the plan, we can start asking questions about why. That's process evaluation. Data-informed process evaluation. I think sometimes we only count the products of program activities. I don't think that's the only thing. It depends upon the service. But when we're providing direct services to individuals, like maybe counseling services, for example, looking at quality indicators is also important. So we've got two aspects of fidelity, quality and quantity. You can take quantity, you can add all of those things up, divide it by the total that you ought to have handed out, or the total number of products that should have been there, and you've got a ratio, you've got a dosage about what exactly it is that, how faithful the program was delivered, a dosage variable or a dosage indicator. Sometimes this is helpful because when we put all this information, we try to analyze this information in a spreadsheet, some people get more of the program than others, right? Some people access food bank more than others. We may be able to look and actually see that those individuals who are accessing food bank more than others are having some successful outcomes. But if we try to aggregate them all together and we only see that one or two individuals access it per year and we're turning in an annual report, those individuals may wash out the effect of the other individuals. So it's important to look at dosage. What about the quality indicators? It's important to look at that as well. That has a major impact, particularly around like human-to-human services, counseling and other sorts of services like that. Looking at engagement. How, you know, are certain individuals more engaged or do they have a better bond with the counselor than others? They're going to have a better experience. Guarantee it. A little bit more on the quantity and the quality. I think that if we are, one of the things about that we don't do very often in program evaluation is if we're comparing status A to status B, we've got to make sure that we know well enough what was happening in both conditions. Otherwise, you know, what happens in research a lot, especially randomized trials with social interventions, this is what I love about a lot of research. We have a randomized controlled trial and we put some students over here and we put some students over there and we give an intervention to these kids and we say they got services as usual. Well, what the heck does that mean? I mean, what are we actually comparing this group? What are we comparing? If we're not monitoring actually what's going on over here and what's going on over here, if we only pay attention to the treatment group, but then we've got this other group that's just kind of hanging out over there, they got services as usual. I mean, what are we can't really directly make a comparison, but it gets glossed over every time. I think this is also true for baseline. Most of you are doing single subject or single system designs. You're not engaging in randomized trials, I would guess. Maybe you're comparing one group against another within your agency, possibly if you're trying to implement a new service and you want to say, you know, is this service effective? Let's compare it to, you know, our services as usual. Make sure you monitor that. But that if you are using a single system design, which is what most program evaluations are doing, that you're really paying attention to what's happening at baseline as best as possible. And then, as I mentioned, estimating the fidelity, comparing compliers with non-compliers, or what I call intent to treat, which is lumping everybody in and saying they got the same, to treatment of the treated, which is using that dosage variable to try to tease out whether there's an effect dependent upon the level of access. Outcomes are really the measurable benefits that we really want to target. And ultimately, you like that? I like that. We see them as short-term, proximal, or immediate. I mean, these are all terms that are used to describe those very first changes that we would expect to see. We're really talking about knowledge, attitudes, we're talking about cognitions possibly if we're engaging in counseling or other kinds of cognitive reforming interventions. These should link logically to interim or medial or intermediate outcomes. This is what we're talking about when we see skills and behaviors and social interactions. A lot of folks, and even in textbooks, talk about skills being a proximal outcome. I would challenge that. Think about what it takes to build a skill. It takes time. You need the knowledge first, right? Then you need to engage your practice in offering the skill. And you need the feedback. And eventually the skill develops. But you don't just get a skill because you get an intervention. I don't understand skills as being proximal, so I think they're more medial. These link to long-term distal impact outcomes. These are the terminal changes that we hope to achieve. A lot of times we're engaged in measuring these things on the individual level, but really when we persist on these things and we look at it over time, conceptually speaking, we could see community level change over 7 to 10 years, depending upon how long we actually measure it, how well we're able to measure it. But as I mentioned earlier, the farther we go out in this process, the less attributable these outcomes are to the actual program that we're offering, right? It's kind of hard to make the link. But if we can do it developmentally over time and actually show these things can link, we can actually make an argument, a valuable argument. There's lots of error in those arguments, but that's okay. We're dealing with human beings, and there's lots of gray area and all of that. So an example, developmental impact of immunization PSAs. Anybody remember a couple of years back, some British researcher had a group of 12 kids with autism that were on the autism spectrum, and he released this ridiculous report where he fabricated some information, and the English media caught up with this, and it hit the world stage, and we still have parents that don't want to immunize their children against child-borne illnesses. So, you know, we've had PSAs over the past few years trying to get back to where we are. We've got public health issues because this one knucklehead with a sample size of 12 affected a major health intervention. It's incredible. Anyway, but really thinking about how this PSA process links over time in changing knowledge, behavior, and the eventual condition, I think is a good example. I don't know if maybe some of you can think about your own programs in the same kind of fashion, but reducing the myths and increasing the knowledge of access, where I can get these immunizations, certainly makes sense to link to increased number of parents taking their children, reporting positive bonds or positive attitudes about immunization and healthcare providers, which ultimately will result in fewer kids having dangerous conditions and better overall health. One way to think about these in logic model format, one thing I do for grants a lot is I will put similar numbers because this idea conceptually links to that idea, and we're going to have multiple ideas. Do not have just one or two or three outcomes, proximal outcomes. You're going to have multiple proximal outcomes because you need to evaluate your programs on multiple indicators of success. Some you're not going to detect change on, and some you will. Don't have one. I'm telling you, it's not a winning strategy. So thinking about linking those across the boxes using a number letter system, some way of linking them across will help communicate your ideas as well in grants.